lithely from his waist, leaned down low, and offered Amber his outstretched hands. "The figurehead is reaching for you. Be cautious," I warned her in a low voice. She did not lower her voice.
"I have no need of caution among old friends. Guide me, Fitz."
I did so reluctantly, and held my breath as the figurehead closed his hands around her ribs as if she were a child. I stood staring as Paragon lifted her in his huge hands. They were the color of a man's hands, swarthy with many days outside, but I could still see the grain of the wizard wood he'd been carved from. Of all the elderling magic, the living figurehead most astonished me, but also created the most unease in me. A dragon, I could understand. It was a creature of flesh and blood, with the same needs and appetites as any animal. But a ship of living wood, something that moved and spoke and apparently thought, but had no need of food or drink, no drive to mate, no hope of progeny? How could one predict the actions or the desires of such a being? From my position as the last person standing on the docks, beside Paragon's ladder, I could hear Amber's voice, but she pitched her words to the figurehead, and I could not make them out. He held her like a doll and looked intently into her face. Having been blinded himself, would he feel sympathy for her? Could a ship carved out of a dragon cocoon feel sympathy? Not for the first time, I confronted how little of his life the fool had shared with me. Here he was known as Amber, a clever, tough woman who had lent her fortune to rebuild Bingtown and help former slaves build new lives in the rain wilds. For this portion of our journey, that was who she must be. Amber, a woman who was still a stranger to me.
"Fitz?"
Lant leaned over Paragon's railing.
"Are you coming?"
"Yes." I climbed up the rope ladder, never as easy a task as it seemed, and stepped onto Paragon's deck. He felt different from Tarman, much closer to human. With wit and skill, I sensed him as a living creature. For now, his attention was focused on Amber. I had a few moments to look around. It had been a long time since I'd been on a ship of this size. I thought back to my journey to the Out Islands and Thick's protracted seasickness. There was an experience I hoped never to repeat. Paragon was smaller than that ship, sleeker and, I suspected, more seaworthy. Paragon was very well kept. The decks were clear, the lines neatly stowed, and even while the ship was tied to the dock, the crew was well occupied. "Where are Spark and Perseverance?" I asked Lant.
"Exploring, with the permission of Captain Brashen. You and I are invited to join the captain and Lady Althea in their stateroom for refreshments and conversation."
I leaned toward the bow where Paragon still held Amber. I was reluctant to leave her literally in the ship's grasp, and equally reluctant to offend the folk offering us free passage to Bingtown. There was a lengthy journey ahead of us, down the rain-wild river and then along the uncertain and boggy coast of the cursed shores until we reached Trader Bay. I wished to be on good terms with all. I doubted the fool would have any caution around the figurehead. Obviously Amber had long ago made her decision to trust him.
"Fitz?"
Lant nudged me.
"I'm coming."
I glanced back at Amber. I could see her face, but not his. The wind off the river was rustling her skirts and stirring the bits of hair that showed around her scarf. She was smiling at something he'd said. Her arms rested easily on top of his hands, as if they were the arms of a comfortable chair. I decided to trust her instincts and followed Lant. The door into the captain's stateroom was open to the spring day, and I heard lively voices. Spark laughed at something. We entered to see Leftrin gripping the back of Per's collar and holding him almost off the floor.
"He's a rascal and a lackwit, so see you work him hard," he announced.
Just as my muscles tightened, Leftrin laughed and gave the grinning boy a half-shove, half-toss toward a well-muscled man of middle years. The man caught my boy by the shoulder and grinned in return, showing very white teeth in a neatly trimmed beard. He slapped Per on the back.
"Running the rigging is what we call it, and yes, you can learn it, but only if Clef, Althea, or I authorize it. We'll tell you when we want you up there and exactly what we want you to do."
A man glanced up at Leftrin.
Does he know any of his knots?
A few, I interjected into the conversation. I found I was smiling at Captain Trell.
Oh, more than a few,
Leftrin objected.
Bellin had him working on them in the evenings, when you were closeted with your lady. We've given him a good start on being a deckhand. But Trell is right, lad. If you venture into the rigging, go the first times with someone who knows what she's about. And listen. Listen exactly, and do exactly, and only what you are told. Do you hear me?
I do, sir. Purr was grinning from one captain to the other. If he'd been a puppy, he'd have been wriggling all over. I felt proud, and a bit jealous. Trell advanced toward me, hand out, and we exchanged a trader's handshake. His dark eyes met mine, a frank and open gaze.
I've never had a prince on board, but Leftrin tells me you're an easy one to deal with. We do our best, but Paragon is a ship, and we live as that dictates.
I assure you, I'm not a grand noble. I spent a fair amount of time pulling an oar on the Rurisk during the Red Ship Wars. My gear was under my bench, and half the time that was my bed as well.
Ah, you'll do well then. I'd like to introduce Althea Vestrit. I've tried to make her a Trell, but she persists in being a Vestrit, stubbornness being the hallmark of her family's women. But if you've met Malta, you'll know that already.
Althea was seated at a table laden with a fat steaming pot, cups, and little cakes on a platter. The pot was elderling made. It had a gleaming metallic finish and was embellished with snakes. No, they were sea serpents, for tiny fish were also there. The little cakes were studded with seeds and bits of bright pink fruit. Althea half stood and leaned over the table to extend her handshake to me.
Don't mind him, though my niece did get more than her fair share of Vestrit's character, as we call it.
The calluses on her hand rasped against mine. Her smile made lines at the corners of her eyes. Her dark hair was threaded with grey and was bound back from her face and braided into a tight queue down her back. Her grip was the equal of any man's, and I felt she took my measure as much as I did hers. She sat down again and said,
"Well, it's a strange pleasure to see the man who wears my ship's face, though doubtless you think of it the other way. Please, come to our table, have a cup of coffee, and tell me how it felt to see the figurehead, Amber, carved to match the man who held her heart."
The silence that follows a very awkward statement has a peculiar noise of its own. I could hear Lant holding his breath and literally feel the wide-eyed stares from Spark and Perseverance. I found a hasty lie.
"Coffee would be welcome. It may be spring, but the wind off the river cuts right down to my bones."
She grinned.
"You never knew she'd carved your face for the ship, did you?"
Was honesty becoming a dangerous habit? What would Shade have thought? I allowed myself an embarrassed laugh and conceded, "Until a very short time ago, I did not."
"Oh, sweet sir,"
Althea muttered, and Brashen brayed out the suppressed laugh that he could hold back no longer. I heard a soft exclamation behind me and turned to find that Elise had joined us.
"Oh, the things our women do to us,"
Brashen exclaimed and came to clap me on the shoulder.
Sit down, and Althea will pour. There's brandy too, and that might take the chill away a bit better. Elise, Lord Lant, will you join us? And, well, if I invite your serving folk to join us, am I breaching manners? You'll have to bluntly advise me on these things."
Travelling rough soon breaks down the walls of protocol. "Perseverance and Spark, would you care to join us for coffee?" Perseverance made a face before he could control his features.
"No, sir. Thank you very much all the same. I'd like to go and look around the ship, if I may."
"You may,"
Althea and Brashen said in unison, and then Brashen thought to look toward me and add,
"That is, if your master approves."
"Of course, Purr. If someone tells you to get out of the way, jump lively."
"I will."
He was halfway to the cabin door when Spark spoke.
"I want,"
she began, and then halted. Her cheeks turned red. Every adult was looking at her. Elise smiled.
"Just say it, dear."
She opened her mouth and then said in a subdued voice,
"I should see to unpacking Lady Amber's things."
"Or,"
Elise suggested,
You could go and look about the deck with Purr, and no harm done for being interested in the ship. From the Rainwilds to Bingtown, women have stood on an equal footing with men for quite some time, even if some forget it from time to time.
She smiled at me.
When you were otherwise occupied, Spark had many questions for Belin and me about Tarman. She learns quickly, and I assure you there's no harm in a girl knowing more than ribbons and sewing.
I defended the Six Duchies. I assure you, in the Six Duchies, we do not confine our women at all. They are minstrels and guards, scribes and huntswomen, or whatever other occupation appeals to them. Spark found her tongue.
I wasn't asking permission, that is, I was, but I also wanted to ask if it would offend if I donned trousers for my time on the ship. For I too would like to climb the rigging, and skirts make it a task even to climb the ship's ladder.
A peculiar look passed over Perseverance's face. He stood, his hand on the door, and looked at Spark as if she had turned into a cat. Althea stood up and dusted her hands on the legs of her well-worn trousers.
I think we could find you some boys' clothing on board the ship.
Spark grinned, and suddenly I saw Ash's countenance.
I've some from home, if no one minds me wearing them.
It won't be noticed at all. I truly don't know how Elise Masters, being ever the lady in lovely skirts.
Althea smiled at her friend before nodding to Spark.
Run off and find your other clothes. All your gear should be on board in your cabins. We're a larger vessel than Tarman, but we're built for cargo, not passengers. I've put Prince Fritz Chivalry and Lady Amber in the same room she once shared with Jack and me. Lord Lant, Clef has offered to share his cabin with you. He's given you the bunk, and we'll hang a hammock for him. Purr we put below decks with the crew.
She gave me an apologetic look.
For now, we put your serving girl in with you and Amber, but...
Actually, I don't mind a hammock below decks alongside Perseverance. It's better than sleeping on an open deck.
Oh, we can do better than that. No need to separate you from your lady.
This from Brashen. We were back to an awkward silence as I sought words. It was broken by a loud shout that vibrated the planks of the deck.
Althea!
Paragon,
she explained unnecessarily.
I'd best see what he needs. Don't wait for me, but help yourself to coffee and cakes. Brashen, would you show them where their cabins are?
Of course.
We must take our leave, I fear.
This from Elise with her hand on Leftrin's arm.
There's cargo to load. It must be tallied as it comes aboard and stored to Leftrin's liking. This cargo cannot brook delay. Young fruit trees in tubs of earth from Bingtown, and ducklings and goslings. I suspect we'll be sorry to have those aboard, but they cannot be worse than the sheep were. Farewell. We enjoyed your company.
Hasty good wishes were exchanged, and they took their leave. After Althea had left, Trell said quietly,
Our ship is out of temper lately. My son is serving aboard a different live ship right now. Vivacia, the Vestrit family ship. Paragon misses him keenly. Sometimes he can be like a spoiled child. If he says anything peculiar to you, let me know.
He looked troubled, and I strove to keep the alarm from my face as I wondered what sort of tantrum a living ship might throw. He avoided meeting my eyes as he added,
Let me show you around a bit. The pot will keep the coffee hot.
As we left the cabin, Lant raised his brows at me, and I gave a shrug. Brashen handed Purr off to the deckhand named Clef. He had an old slave tattoo beside his nose and a long tarred braid down his back.
Got your gear below,
he said to Purr, with an echo of a foreign accent faded beyond recognition. They went off together, and I smiled to see Purr unconsciously mimic the sailor's walk. Lant followed them. Brashen led Spark and me to a cabin that was largely occupied by Amber's and Spark's baggage. My own pack seemed small in comparison with their bulging bags. I wondered if they had acquired more garments in Kelsengrar, and how we would manage when it came time to carry our possessions on our backs. My smaller pack, that held Bee's books and Molly's candles, had safely crossed to Paragon. The elderling firebrick resided there as well. I hefted it, and knew that below Shade's carefully packed firepots, my shirt still bundled the heavy glass containers of skill. Amber had taken charge of the lovely bracelet. Spark immediately burrowed into her bag like a hound in search of a remembered bone. We left her there. As we walked toward the bow, Trell introduced me to crew members. They gave a nod or smile, but never paused in their tasks. Kittle, Cord, Twan, Half, Ant, Jock, Cyprus. I stacked the names in my memory and tried to attach them to faces. Ant was halfway up the mast, and my heart jumped when she waved at me with both hands. Trell was not amused.
"One hand for yourself and one for the ship," he roared. "You don't take unnecessary risks on my deck. I'll put you right back in the tree you came from."
"Sir,"
she responded, and went scampering up the mast like a squirrel avoiding a barking dog. Trell rolled his eyes.
"If she lives to grow up, she'll be a great deckhand, but she doesn't have a scrap of fear, and that may get her killed."
He gestured at Treehog.
"When a child grows up there, the mast of a ship seems short."
I followed his waving hand. The towering trees that held Treehog dwarfed the naked masts of the Paragon. The swooping branches of the dense forest were as busy with foot traffic as the streets and byways of any city. Everywhere throughout the trees were signs of human habitation. Signboards advertised a tavern, while another in the shape of a basket advertised all manner of wickerwork. I saw some people veiled, as I had always heard the Rainwilders went, and others with exposed faces and bared arms that revealed scales and growths. A wicker lift was hoisted into the upper branches while pedestrians travelled up and down a stairway that spiralled around the trunk. I had stopped to gawk and realized that Brashen was waiting for me.
"Did you grow up here?" I asked Brashen.
"Here? Oh, no. I'm Bingtown born and bred, from an illustrious trade of family. But I'm the black sheep, and not the heir. So here I am, captaining a live ship instead of minding the family fortune."
He was clearly well satisfied with his lot.
"Not too different from my tale," I told him. "Amber may call me a prince, but my name tells the truth. Fitz means I was born on the wrong side of the blankets, so I'm a farseer, but a bastard one."
"That's so. Well, that explains why you might end up on the end of an oar on a war galley."
I grinned. "Yes, bastards are a bit more expendable than princes." And that simply, we were at ease with each other. We strolled toward the bow. I could hear voices, Amber's and Althea's, and the ship's, but the wind off the river and the noise of the tree city meant I could not make out their words.
"Vengeance, then?"
Althea asked as we drew closer.
"More than vengeance," Amber replied. "We go to break a cage of cruelty, to destroy a court that has grown only greedier and more corrupt with every passing year."
She lowered her voice and spoke the words I had so often heard from her.
"We go to be the rock in the cart track that bounces the wagon onto a new path."
They could not have presented a stranger scene. Althea leaned on the ship's railing. The ship's face was turned toward the river with my more youthful profile. Amber sat in the figurehead's finger-laced hands. Her hands rested lightly on his thumbs, and she swung her daintily booted feet, ankles crossed, over the empty fall to the cold, acid rush of the river. Her scarf allowed a feathering of short hair to frame her face. Powder and paint had smoothed her scarring and the scaling that the dragon's blood had triggered. In Amber's guise, the fool became a very fetching woman. Althea's voice was subdued.
"I've never heard you speak with such passion, not even when we were facing our deaths together."
Amber's face contorted with hatred.
"They took our child and destroyed her."
It hurt to hear Amber claim be that way, and I knew what Althea and Brashen must assume. The fool might believe it was so, but to hear him speak of her that way to strangers wounded something in me.
"Molly,"
I thought fiercely. She had been Bee's mother, and no other. I did not wish these people to think I had fathered Bee upon Amber. No, Molly had been the one to endure that pregnancy, in some ways, so alone, and Molly had been the one to cherish and protect a child that others would have let dwindle away. It wasn't right for Amber to erase her. The hurt seared me, and I realized it had another source.
"My boy is gone, too."
Paragon burst out, and I felt the surge of emotion that washed through the ship. His sense of outrage and loss were fueling the fire of hurt within me. Trell spoke calmingly.
Boyo is fine, Paragon. Vivaseer would never let harm befall him. He is only gone from you for a time. He will return, you know that.
Will he?
Paragon demanded harshly.
He has been gone 2 years. Will he ever come back? Or will Vivaseer claim him? He was born here, on my decks. He is mine. Or am I the only live ship without a family? The only live ship with no heir to my captaincy? For even as Althea's brother demands my boy for his deck, he keeps from me what should be mine. Kennet's son.
Queen Etta keeps Paragon Kennetsome from you, not Wintrow.
Althea's voice was taut. I could hear it was not the first time she had uttered those words to the ship. I saw Brashen square his shoulders and step forward, prepared to take up the peacemaker's role.
Paragon, Amber said softly. My friend, I feel your anguish. It is almost too much to be borne. Please.
And then breathlessly,
you are holding me too tightly. Please, please set me safely on your decks.
I stared helplessly. I had two small concealed knives, useless weapons against such a huge opponent. If I attacked him, would he drop Amber into the river? I looked to Brashen, but his face had gone pale. Althea leaned further over the railing. She spoke in a low, rational voice.
Crushing your friend will not win you, Kennet's son. Calm yourself, ship.
What need of breath did a wooden ship have, even one carved from a dragon's cocoon? Yet Paragon's chest rose and fell as if he were a boy in the grip of strong emotion. His eyes were squeezed shut, and the big hands that clutched Amber trembled. Amber's milky eyes were fixed, not on me, but on a nameless distance. Her face was flushed with breathlessness. Paragon drew his hands closer to his chest. He bent his head over her, and I feared he would bite her head off. But instead, he twisted his shoulders and released her onto the deck so abruptly that she staggered and fell. Althea dropped to one knee beside her, seized her shoulders, and dragged her backward.
You needn't put her out of my reach, Paragon complained hoarsely. I would not hurt her.
I know you wouldn't,
Amber gasped. Althea was small, but she hoisted Amber's arm across her shoulders and stood up with her.
I'm taking Amber to our stateroom, she announced calmly.
Before I could step in, Brashen seized Amber's other arm and helped her to walk aft. I began to follow, but the ship suddenly spoke.
You, with my face, don't go.
I halted. Brashen stopped and looked back at me, his eyes wide. A small shake of his head was full of warning. Lance's gaze went from me to Amber. I tipped my head toward her, letting him know he should follow her, and he quickly took Brashen's place. The captain folded his arms and stood, watching the figurehead.
Buckman, I want to talk to you. Come here.
The ship wasn't looking at me. He was staring off across the wide rain-wild river. The distant shore was a haze of green on the horizon.
I'm here,
I said, striving to keep any challenge out of my voice. The ship gave no sign he had heard me. I stood and waited. I heard the river and the ship's motion against the dock. The distant calls and shouts of the riverside city were like birdsong in the distance.
Buckman?
I stepped closer and raised my voice.
I'm here, ship. No!
Brashen's warning was too late. With a twist of his body that set the ship rocking against the dock, the figurehead turned, reached, and grabbed me. I leapt back, but he caught my left shoulder and arm. I seized one of his fingers in my right hand and tried to lift and twist it. Useless, he dragged me off my feet and pinned me against the railing.
Let him go, Paragon!
Brashen bellowed. The lurch of the ship had alerted the crew. Clef came running, then jolted to a halt, staring at me, with a white-faced purr at his elbow. Two others, Cord and Half, hurried toward us, then stopped. Althea halted, her arm still around Amber. I could not hear what she said, but Amber swiveled back to gaze blindly back at us. Paragon spoke calmly, and his words vibrated through me.
"This does not concern any of you. Busy yourself with your duties."
"Paragon?"
Althea pleaded. Paragon tightened his grip, lifting me up onto my toes. His thumb and fingers pinched the left side of my chest. I didn't struggle. When you cannot win, avoid angering the opponent. Give him no reason to employ more force.
"We're fine,"
I gasped. I held onto his fingers, trying to ease the pressure.
"About your duties,"
Paragon suggested pleasantly, and I nodded in vehement agreement. Althea began moving Amber away. She went reluctantly, looking back at me, but I could not read her expression. Clef gripped Per's shoulder and dragged him along. Lant came to help him. Brashen, his mouth flat in a bitter line, retreated from us. Paragon eased me onto my feet, but kept me wedged against the railing.
"Now," he said in a very soft voice, "we will talk, you and I, to be sure that things are clear between us. Are you listening, Buckman? For that is your role in this conversation. You listen."
I wheezed a response.
"I'm listening." "Excellent. Amber seems to be fond of you. Perhaps she has been fond of you for years."
He paused.
I nodded. "Friends since childhood."
The pressure eased.
"Friends?"
Since I was a boy." He made a deep sound that I felt all through my body. Then he said,
"Understand this. We share a face, though mine is more youthful and handsomer. I asked her to carve me a face she could love. She gave me yours, but it was could love, not did love. Remember that. She loves me far more than you. She always will."
On the last three words, his grip on me tightened. I nodded breathlessly. Overhead, I heard a worried caw. I could not look up, but I knew that Motley was circling. I prayed she would not try to attack the ship.
"Please don't,"
I flung the thought at her. Paragon snapped his fingers open. I clutched the railing so I did not fall. For an instant, I thought he had responded to my wit. Then he gave me a threatening smile.
"So, we understand each other?"
"Yes." I fought the impulse to flee. I did not want to turn my back to him, even if he had turned his to me. He put his gaze on the water, crossed his arms on his chest, and rolled his shoulders. Substantial musculature there. I was not sure I'd ever truly looked like that. He held his silence. A step at a time, I retreated, keeping my eyes fixed on him until someone seized my collar and dragged me backward. I kicked my heels against the deck to speed the process, and we both went down in a heap. Brashen huffed out his air as we hit the deck with me on top.
"You're welcome,"
he wheezed as I rolled off him and staggered upright.
"Thank you," I responded. "Are you all right?"
Amber was immediately beside me as Althea offered Brashen a hand up. Per darted to my side and seized my hand. "I'm bruised, but not badly injured, other than my pride." I turned to Althea and Brashen. "You warned me. I didn't imagine he could move that quickly, or be that..." I flailed for a word.
"Deceptive,"
Brashen supplied for me. He sighed.
"He's been difficult lately." "More difficult than usual,"
Althea amended. She took Amber's hand and hauled her to her feet.
"It's a strange welcome back for you, Amber, but I'm sure you recall Paragon's nature. He'll be steady and stable for a month or a year, then something will set him off."
"Jealousy," I said very quietly. "Amber, he does not wish to share you."
"I will do my best to calm him, but it is not just that. Paragon's hull and figurehead were created out of two logs of wizard wood. He has the nature and partial memories of two dragons. His decks were the scene of much violence and cruelty. He was captured by the notorious pirate Igrot and used as his personal vessel. And Kennet Ludlock, the son of his family, was tormented on board him. Tormented and twisted."
She added in a whisper,
"Cruelty begets cruelty."
"Deliberate cruelty is never forgivable,"
Althea said brusquely. Amber nodded curtly.
"I understand that now, perhaps better than I once did."
We moved away from the foredeck. Brashen tossed his chin at the crewman who was staring at us, and they suddenly stirred to life. I gently pried my arm from Per's grip. "I'm fine," I told him. "Get to learning the ship. I'll call you if I need you." He looked doubtful, but Clef gave a sharp whistle, and the boy perked like a summoned dog. "Go on," I told him, knowing it was what he longed to do and what was best for him, and he went. With a sudden rattle of black feathers, Motley swooped in to land on Per's shoulder. Clef startled, and Per laughed. The tension broke like a bubble popping. I left him explaining the bird to Clef and Ant. We hadn't gone more than a dozen steps when Ash abruptly appeared.
"Is all well?"
he demanded anxiously in a voice so boyish I knew he had changed his self along with his clothing. I felt a pang that we had stolen this superlative young spy just when Shade might need him most, but I also knew that her dual identity could not be used aboard the ship. "It is Spark," I told her. She gave me an odd look. "You can relax," I added. I pointed toward Clef and suggested, "Go explore the ship with Per." She gave me a girl's relieved smile and trotted off with an eagerness that told me I'd given her exactly the right prompt. Althea ambushed me at the stateroom door with sparks of anger in her eyes.
"You can't be careless on this ship. We warned you."
"You did," I agreed. "He tricked me into coming within range. It was my own fault." My agreement set her back. Amber groped out and I offered her my arm. She gripped it tightly.
"Ah, Fitz, as you do not know Paragon's history, you cannot be as terrified as I was." "We need to get underway. People are staring. The sooner we are away from Treehog, the less they have to gossip about,"
Brashen suggested tersely. I looked toward the city. Yes, people were pointing, others just gaping. I wondered how many had witnessed what had happened, and how Paragon's jealousy would be interpreted by those who had not heard his words.
"Walk me to my room, please. I'm still recalling the ship,"
Amber lied, giving me a graceful way to depart. They didn't even ask what he'd said to me, I observed quietly.
"Some of it we overheard. I had no idea he would feel so possessive of me."
"Must you be so pleased about it?" I demanded. She laughed.
"I'd feared that he had forgotten me."
"After you recarved his face and gave him back his sight?"
"Paragon is changeable. One moment he's an adoring child, the next a vindictive, angry adolescent. Sometimes he is manly and brave and chivalrous, but I never lean too strongly on any of his moods, for I know how quickly they can shift."
"Have you really forgotten your way around the ship?" A rueful smile twisted her mouth.
"Fitz, you have such amazing faith in me. I haven't been on this ship in decades. I can recall the layout, but will I know how many steps from fore to aft? How many steps in a ladder? When to duck for a doorway? No, yet I must walk as if I am confident of the way. I know that when I grope or cling to a wall, I become less of a person and more of an obstacle. So I pretend I can see more than I do."
I'm sorry. And I was, and disheartened. I thought again of the long and weary way he had come, alone and horrendously wounded, blind in the snow.
Is this the door?
She asked. I think so. I was more rattled than I wanted to admit. I'd been stupid. I kept trying to think of what I should have done when Paragon seized me.
I thought you were leading me.
I was letting you hold my arm while we walked. I tapped on the door, and when no one answered, I opened it. I see your things, everywhere. There are three bunks and a fold-down table. Spark's pack is open, and she has obviously rummaged through it. Amber entered and allowed herself to grope and touch. I shut the door behind us. She moved carefully in the small room, measuring distances in careful steps and the reach of her arms.
I recall it, she said, as she perched on the lower bunk. I once shared this room with Althea and Jack. Three people crowded into this space. It was tense at times.
I pushed my pack completely under the lowest bunk and set my bag of clothing by the door. Crowding does that to you. I sat down beside her. The motion of the ship had changed, and I did not find it pleasant. We'd cast off from the dock, and the current of the river was taking charge. I looked out the small porthole. We were picking up speed and moving away from shore into a deeper channel and swifter current. I'd never liked the sensation of being disconnected from the ground. The pace of a horse had a rhythm. A ship might lurch in any direction at any moment. I tried to settle my stomach into accepting the unpredictable.
What's wrong?
She asked softly. I'm not seasick, but I don't enjoy the motion. I'd just become accustomed to Tarman's waddle, but Paragon...
No, what's really worrying you?
He spoke as the fool. I didn't look at him. Was there anyone else I could admit this to? Probably not. I'm not what I used to be. I make more mistakes, and they're more serious. I think I'm alert and ready and fit for anything, and then I'm not. Things and people take me by surprise. Brashen seizes me from behind, and I'm so focused on Paragon, not even my wit let me know he was there. Despite being warned, the ship lured me into coming within his arm's reach with almost no effort. He could have killed me in an instant.
Fitz, how old are you?
Exactly. I'm not sure. You know that.
Take a guess,
he chided me. I blew out my distaste for the subject. 62? Perhaps 63? 64, maybe. But I don't look it, and most days I don't feel it.
But you are it. It's going to take its toll. You had a good life, for a time, an easy life, with Molly. Calm and prosperity dull a man's edge, just as endless battle and hardship dulls the gentler parts of the soul.
It was good, fool. I wanted it to be forever. I wanted to grow old and to die with her sitting by my bed.
But you didn't get that.
No. I got this. Chasing across half the world to kill people I don't know, people who didn't know me, but still came to destroy what little peace and joy I had left. As I put words to that, I felt a fury that would have let me snap a man's neck. Dwalia. I could have broken her in half with my bare hands at that moment. Then it passed, and I felt foolish and empty, and worst of all, incompetent. I spoke a guilty fear. They lured me away from Withywoods, didn't they, so they could raid it while I was away?
I fear they did.
How could they plan that? He had explained it before, but I wanted to hear it again.
They have access to thousands of prescient dreams from scores of young whites. They could find the right circumstances to nudge you in the direction they desired.
And you?
Probably I was part of it. Did I escape, or was I released? Were the chance strangers who helped me along the way truly kind, or were they conspirators with the servants? I don't know, Fitz. But I don't think you can blame yourself.
I make too many mistakes. I had my sword at Elik's throat, and my strength gave out. When I should have followed B into the skill pillar, my magic was gone. So many mistakes, fool. How roughly I healed those children. I looked at his empty eyes. And just now with Paragon, stupid, stupid, stupid. I reached to seize his gloved hand. Fool, I am not competent to do what you want done. I'm going to fail you, drag you down into torture and death with me. Will Lantern purr and Spark fall with us? Will we listen to Purr scream? Watch Spark abused and torn? I can't stand it. I can't stand to think of it. Do you wonder that I want to send them home, that I am terrified of bringing anyone with me into this? I fear failing all of you, as I have feared nothing else in my life. I'll fall for some tricks of theirs. How can I battle people who even now may know what I'm likely to do next? They might know that we are on our way to kill them.
Oh, I consider that likely,
the fool observed heartlessly, then added quietly,
You're hurting me.
I released my clutch, and he massaged his hand. His words had quenched my last spark of courage. In our silence, the moving ship spoke around us. I heard the water and the creaking of Paragon's wizard wood timbers. Felt the press of his sentience and tightened my walls. This is insane. I can't do this. We'll both die, possibly messily.
Probably so, but what else would we do with the rest of our lives?
I thought about that like a wolf chewing on a bare bone, or chewing on his leg in a trap.
Night eyes, he said.
He's gone, I said dully. If I still had him, I wouldn't feel so diminished. His senses were so sharp, and he shared all with me. But he's gone completely now. I used to feel him inside me sometimes. I could almost hear him, usually mocking me. But I don't even have that anymore. He's just gone.
That's not what I meant, though I'm sad to hear it. No, I was recalling Night Eyes at the end of his life. You wanted to heal him, and he refused. How you tried to leave him safe while we went after the piebalds, and he came after you.
I smiled, remembering my wolf's determination to live until he died. What are you saying? He spoke solemnly.
This is our last hunt, old wolf. And as we always have, we go to it together.
Chapter 13. Full Sails. I am so bothered when the dreams make no sense, but still swell with importance. It is hard to write down a story that has no sequence or sense, let alone make a picture of what my dream showed me. But here it is. A flaming man offers a drink to my father. He drinks it. He shakes himself like a wet dog, and pieces of wood fly in all directions. He turns into two dragons that fly away. I am almost certain that this dream will come to pass. A dream that makes no sense.
Dream Journal of B. Farseer.
It was a chill and rainy day. I wore my old jerkin over the cheap, loose shirt and trousers Dwalia had grudgingly purchased for me in Chaleshead. The layers were uncomfortable, but I had no coat. Kerf, Vindelire, and I had fled the stench in the tiny cabin. We huddled in the skimpy shelter of the deckhouse eaves and watched the heaving grey seas amid the endless, pattering rain. Few merchants wished to take the air that day. The two who trudged past us in deep conversation made my heart leap with hope.
6 days to Walton. I'll part with my Sands Edge brandy there for a tidy profit. I want to look at their currant liqueur. It has a tartness that wakes the tongue and is as good a tonic for a man as it is a pleasure to the ladies.
He was a small man, lithe as a rat, and dressed all in ratty grey. The tall woman beside him laughed and shook her head. The bangles in her ears brushed her shoulders. A nest of yellow braids crowned her head, hatless in the rain.
I've no stock to sell there, but I hope to acquire an item or two.
It's not called Walton for nothing. Their weavers make magnificent rugs. If I take one as a gift to my buyer in the Spice Isles, he may spend his client's money a bit more freely. I'll be glad to get off this ship for a bit. We've a layover there before a 7-day run to Cart's Cove, if this wind holds. The wind is good, but this rain I'd wish gone. Storm is good by me.
The woman looked up, letting the rain fall on her face. The man stared at her bared throat.
Last chance of pirates or the tariff fleet spotting us, but I'm looking forward to a couple of days on dry land.
2 days in port, 2 days in which to find a way off the ship and out of Dwalia's custody. 6 days to win Vindalaya over to my cause. If he fled with me and kept us both hidden, what chance would Dwalia have of finding us? I knew that luring him from his path would be like luring a wild bird from a berry bush. The wrong words might frighten him off completely. I would have to be very careful. I put myself on a strict schedule. For 3 days I would court his friendship. Only on the fourth would I begin to persuade him to help me. Kerf hunched beside me, his shoulders bowed against the rain, his face nearly blank with Vindalai's overlay of servitude. I felt sorry for him. He looked like a once proud stallion hitched to a dung cart. At night, when he stripped for sleep, I noticed the slackening of the muscles in his arms and chest. Under Vindalaya's sway, he moved less and less like a warrior and more like a servant. Much more of this, and he would lose his usefulness as a protector. I wondered if Dwalia saw that. On the other side of me, Vindalaya slumped. He had an odd face, sometimes boyish, and at other times the face of a disappointed old man. It had fallen into dismal folds today as he stared at the waves.
"So far from home,"
he said woefully.
"Tell me of our destination, brother." Being asked to speak always flattered him. I had become the avid listener, never correcting or silencing him. "What will it be like when we arrive there?"
"Oh,"
he breathed out long, as if he did not know where to begin.
"It depends on where we land. We may dock in deep water on the other side of the island. We may land in Cecil, or perhaps Crupton. Dwalia will be known there. I hope for a night in a comfortable inn and a good meal. Lamb with mint, perhaps. I like lamb. And a warm, dry room."
He paused as if already savouring those simple pleasures.
"She may hire a carriage to take us to Clary's. I hope she does not want to ride there on horseback. A horse's back has never fit my bottom well."
I nodded sympathetically.
"And we will go to Clary's. Perhaps we may dock there. It will depend on what sort of a ship we can find. It will be a full summer when we arrive. Hot for you, little northern thing that you are. Nice for me. I will welcome the sun baking the aches out of my joints. Clary's gleams white on a sunny day. Some of it is built of ancient bone, and other parts are white stone."
"Bone? That sounds frightening."
"Does it? Not to me. Worked bone can be lovely. When we get there, we will wait for low tide to bear the causeway and then cross to our island sanctuary. Surely you have heard of it. The tops of the watchtowers are shaped like the skulls of ancient monsters. At night, the torches inside make the eyes gleam with orange light, and they appear to be looking out in all directions. It is imposing and powerful."
He stopped and scratched his wet cheek. Rain dripped from his chin. Then he leaned closer and lowered his voice to impart an important secret to me.
"The furniture in the four towers is made from dragon's bones. Symph has a set of drinking cups carved from dragon's teeth and lined with silver. They are very old, passed down from Symph to Symph through the generations."
"Symph to Symph?" He lifted his pale brows.
"The woman in the North Tower is always called Symph."
"How can you not know these things?"
"I was taught them when I was very young. Clarys is the heart of the world, and the heartbeat of the world must always be steady.
This last he said as if repeating an adage known the world over. Until you took me, I knew nothing of the servants or Clarys. It was not quite a lie. I had read a tiny bit about them in my father's papers, but not enough to prepare me for what I now endured.
Perhaps it is because you are so young,
Vindelire replied thoughtfully. He gave me a pitying look. I shook my head. My hair was now long enough to turn to curls in the rain, and droplets flew from it. I don't think they are as famed as you believe them to be. Curf, had you heard of Clara's before the servants hired you? He turned slowly toward me, blue eyes widening in slow consternation, like a puzzled cow.
Hush, Vindelire warned me. Don't ask him questions.
Vindelire furrowed his brow, and as he did, Curf's face settled into his habitual scowl. Alertness faded from his eyes. I stood up suddenly and stretched, choosing to do so just as two young deckhands dashed by. Both avoided me, but one turned to look back at me in surprise. I looked directly at him, smiling. He stumbled, caught himself, turned back, and I think he would have spoken to me if someone hadn't roared a rebuke at him. The command was accompanied by the sound of a rope length snapping against the ship's railing. Both boys fled to their work. I sat down slowly. Vindelire was breathing through his nose as harshly as if he had just run a race. The world settled around me as if I had been paddling on the surface of a sea and now sank in stillness below the waves. I avoided his gaze as I tried to quote what he had said. Clarys is the heart of the world, and the heartbeat of the world must always be steady. I peered at him through a sudden blast of rain. I could not tell if the water running down his face was rain or tears. His chin quivered briefly.
We who serve the servants aid them to keep that heart beating steadily. If we obey, if we keep to the path.
But what about you? I asked him. What harm if you went to a festival and ate roasted nuts and drank spiced cider? There's no evil in that. His little round eyes were full of misery.
But no good either. I must do only what keeps the world to the path. Harm can come of simple things. The cake I eat, another person lacks. Like tiny pebbles that shift till the hillside gives way, carrying a road into oblivion.
Had I heard such a thing a long time ago? His words rang strangely, even as I hated the sense of them. If he believed that Dwalia knew his destiny and he followed her direction, I had no hope of enlisting his help to escape. As if he heard my thought, he said,
That is why I cannot help you defy her. If you try to escape, I must stop you and bring you back.
He shook his head.
She was very angry when you ran away in the city. I said I could not make you be obedient. I did it once, that first time. The power was fresh and strong on me that day. She had readied me for the hard work I did. But since then, I cannot make you obey me. She said I was lying. She slapped me many times.
His tongue moved inside his cheek as if finding sore places. I felt a rush of guilty sympathy for him. Oh, brother, I said, and took his hand. It was like thrusting my hand into a cold rush of water. I felt the current that strongly, like touching my father when his thoughts were unguarded, before I had learned how to protect myself. I felt that his current snatched the thoughts from my mind. I sensed his hold on Curf like a strangling rope around his mind. Curf was no weakling. It was taut with tension, a leash on a lunging dog. I snatched my hand back and tried to disguise what I'd felt by patting his sleeved arm sympathetically. I am sorry she punished you for that. He stared at me.
You thought of your father.
My heart was beating very fast.
Walls, walls, walls.
I miss my father constantly, I said. He reached for me and I stood up. I'm so cold. I'm going inside. Curf, are you not cold? Kerf's eyes flickered, and Vindelire was distracted as he brought his lunging dog to heel again. By the time he had mastered Kerf and had him standing to follow me, I was out of his reach, on my way back to the cabin. A deckhand, coiling a rope, paused in his activity and stared at me. So Vindelire had been concealing me and controlling Kerf, but doing both at the same time strained his abilities. A useful bit of information. However, I'd handed him a weapon I wished he did not have. Did he guess that if he touched me, skin to skin, he might be able to push inside my mind? I did not look back at him or let my thoughts dwell on that. I must do better at guarding my thoughts. I now doubted that I'd be able to lure either Vindelire or Kerf into helping me. An old sailor strode past me, wet shirt plastered to his back, bare feet slapping the deck. He did not even glance at me. I reached the hatch and climbed down the ladder that led into the bowels of the ship, where our miserable compartment awaited me. I threaded my way past dangling hammocks and sea chests. As I went, I studied those I passed. A few Chalcedian merchants had clustered to mutter about weather and pirates. I paused near them. None looked at me, but from their talk I learned that our ship was bragged to be the swiftest out of Chalced. She had never been boarded by pirates, though she had been pursued by them more than once. She had also avoided encounters with the so-called Tariff Fleet and slipped unnoticed past the pirate isles without paying toll to Queen Etta and her cutthroats. "Are the pirate ships that might chase this ship part of the Tariff Fleet?" I asked aloud, but no one turned toward me. Yet a moment later, a younger fellow at the edge of the huddle said, "It seems ironic to me that a queen who rules a domain called the Pirate Isles is now troubled herself by pirates." A grey-moustached merchant laughed aloud.
"Ironic and very satisfying to those of us who once had to run the Pirate Isles corridor, hoping to escape the attention of King Kennet. He'd take ship, crew, and cargo and turn it all to his own purposes. Anyone who could not bring a ransom ended up a resident of the Pirate Isles."
"Kennet or Ygritte?" asked the youngster.
"Kennet,"
the older man affirmed.
"Ygritte was before my time, and a much more brutal beast. He'd take the cargo, slaughter and rape the crew, and then scuttle the vessel. He had a live ship and nothing outruns one of those. He choked trade for years, then one day he simply vanished."
He widened his eyes at the younger man and mockingly asserted,
"Some say that on a stormy night, you can glimpse his ghost ship in the distance with her sails blazing and the figurehead shrieking in agony."
There was a moment of silence as the young man stared at him, and then all burst into laughter.
"Do you think we'll elude Queen Etta's Tariff Fleet?"
the younger man asked, trying to regain a bit of dignity. The older merchant tucked his hands into his ornate sash. He pursed his lips and waxed philosophical.
"We will, or we won't. The deal I struck was that if the ship can get us past the Tariff Fleet, I'll pay the captain half what I would have paid them. It's a good bargain, and it's one I've made with him before. On 3 voyages out of 5, we slipped past them. Good odds, I think. That little offer of mine makes him willing to crack on a bit more sail, I do believe."
"Good odds indeed,"
the young man replied. I heard awkward steps coming down the ladder and looked up to see Kerf descending with Vindelire following him.
"There you are," I said brightly. "I hurried ahead to be out of the rain."
Kerf said nothing, but Vindelire regarded me with a scowl.
"We'd best return to our cabin,"
he said stiffly. He walked Kerf past me. I stood where I was.
"What will become of me?"
I demanded aloud.
"What does Dwalia intend for me? Why did she come so far, destroy so much and shed so much blood? She sold Elaria into slavery to get us away from Chalced, without a thought for one who had travelled so far with her. Why didn't she sell me, or you?"
"Hush!"
Vindelire spoke in a soft whisper.
"I cannot speak to you here."
"Is that because they cannot hear me, or see me, and they will think you a madman, talking to yourself?"
I lifted my voice and spoke each word clearly. I saw his control of Kerf slipping as one of the men turned his head, scowling, wondering if he'd heard something. An instant later, Vindelire had Kerf blank-eyed again. He looked at me, trembling from the effort. There was a tremor in his voice as he said,
"Brother, please."
I should have felt only hatred for him,
He had facilitated my capture and kept me subdued as they whisked me away. He had hidden Shan and me